You're listening to Journals of the Willing from the Tumbling Saber team, a part of the Star Wars Commonwealth Podcast Network. Check us out on the web at StarWarsCommonwealth.com, on Facebook, iTunes, and Twitter, and take your first step into a larger world. Hey everybody, welcome back to Journals of the Willing. My name is Kyle, and with me, as always, is Steve. And this week, as we look to Star Wars on the printed page, we're going to take a look at Empire's End. But before we do that, let's be polite. Steve, how you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. How are you doing?
I'm also well. I'm a little bit bummed. My hockey team just dropped game one of their playoff series, and they looked very bad doing so. So I'm a little bit irked, but anyway, that's neither here nor there. It's a big week for Star Wars fans. Celebration is just about to get underway. I don't know if you've been watching Twitter at all, but we see people pouring into Orlando and tweeting their little hearts out. And you know, God love them. I'm happy for everybody that's going. And I hope they make some great memories. But I'm a little bit jealous. How about you?
I think that's it. It's like I'm excited to see it, and I'm like living vicariously through them. But yeah, part of me is just, yeah, kind of very jealous. So I'm probably not looking at as many tweets as I could be.
Yeah, I saw some people tweeting, more than one person tweeting that they were on the same flight as Hayden Christensen, and that they were freaking out a little. And one person had tweeted a picture of Mark Hamill in line at the airport. Oh, come on, man.
Oh, jeez.
My knees would probably buckle if I saw Mark Hamill in person just randomly in public like that.
I'm the worst when it comes to seeing celebrities. Like, I always tell myself, or I tell people, yeah, no, I'm totally chill. When it actually happens, not so much. I lose all chill.
Oh, you become like a babbling mess?
Yeah. For example, I used to work at the Today Show before going to grad school, and I absolutely love Jessica Lange. I'm a big horror fan, so she was doing American Horror Story at the time. And I tried so hard, because she was doing her interview, I was in the back, and then when she was kind of going out to her ride, I tried so hard to keep my cool. I just wanted to say, like, how much I loved her on the show, and whatever. It just came out so babbly. She kind of just, like, looked at me. It was a little awkward. She was like, thanks.
Beat you with her purse and took off.
Yeah. Oh, jeez.
Spray you with some mace.
Right. It was just like, who's this awkward prop kid?
Oh, man. Hey, you got to make those stories.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if it was Mark Hamill, I don't know. Well, I guess Mark Hamill, he's so cool. He probably gets it all the time. And he's so awesome. He's great with the fans. So I imagine he... You know, he's not really as put off by that, I'd hope. I don't know.
I would imagine he's probably used to people just spilling over themselves and unable to form words.
Right. He's got it.
He probably has some go-to lines like, oh, would you like to take a selfie? As you sit there and stuttering and stammering and unable to put together a sentence.
Right. It's kind of some move it along, right?
Yeah. Let me just end this pain for you right now. Come here. Let's take a selfie. Yeah, but anyway, Celebration's about to get underway. Tomorrow, by the time people start really digging into this podcast, hopefully we get some love on the interwebs, and people make some time for us as they stream panels from Orlando.
Yeah, please love us.
We need the validation. But yeah, I mean, I know what I'll be doing tomorrow once I get into the office, so I will definitely fire up StarWars.com and hit that stream button and be listening, because we're going to get some juicy stuff.
Oh, I can't wait. So do they release the schedule of, like, what panels are up first and when we should be getting everything?
I think it's all up there, but all I'm looking for is the 40th anniversary panel, which is tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern.
Ugh.
I believe that's being streamed. And then on Friday... same deal. 11 a.m. Eastern is going to be the Last Jedi panel, in which I expect we'll get the trailer for the Last Jedi, or a teaser, or a sizzle reel, Whatever they want to give us, I am willing to accept.
Well, I'm sure we'll get something. I don't know. I'm going to have to sneak my phone in the office and just kind of like have it at the corner of the workstation.
Yeah, I just may have to just be honest with my coworkers and say I'm not working. For the next hour and a half, I am just not working.
Nope.
All right, so how about we get into Empire's End here?
Let's do it.
So, the third and final chapter of Chuck Wendig's gigantic three-part epic tale. The one thing I'll say right off the hop is that this series got much better as it went along. So the first book was really tough to get through as it introduced all kinds of new characters. And I think it came out of left field where a lot of people were expecting it to be the further adventures of Han, Luke, and Leia. It was anything but. We barely heard those names whispered in part one. Instead, we struggled to get used to all of these new names that, I don't want to know about Nora Wexley. Who's this? Get out of here. Get out of here. All the, Singer and John Barrow. Get lost. Where's Han? Where's Luke? Was that your impression as you went through the first part?
I mean, I definitely agree with most fans. I think going into it, yeah, we were expecting something completely different than what we got. But I don't know. I mean, I agree with you, though. I mean, Wendig really had the long game in mind for the trilogy. I mean, we really needed that first book to at least get us to care about these characters. Because, I mean, we certainly got, you know, the continuing adventures of Han and Leia moving forward. You know, they were weaved in a lot more in 2 and 3. But I think, yeah, that initial, you know, because it was part of the lead up to The Force Awakens. So we thought, you know, we were going to get this huge bridge story. You know, they were going to start to fill in this 30 year gap. And yeah, we didn't quite get what we were expecting. But I think in the long run, I mean, I think it totally paid off.
Yeah, I think fans or readers were rewarded for patience because you needed a lot of it, at least to get through the first book. And then the second book started to see some dividends as Han and Chewie entered the picture. There was more Leia, Admiral Akbar was in there, Mon Mothma. And you started to see, slowly but surely, all these things that fans were really hoping for start to coalesce. And of course, we still had these new characters, but now they weren't so new anymore. We had the tough intro out of the way, and we can get into the meat and potatoes of their stories. Now, as we fast forward to Empire's End, you know, part two left us, you know, right on the cusp of the Battle of Jakku, which meant that once you got into part three, it was going to be all action all the time, which was pretty much what we got, I would think. I thought this book was, I'm not going to call it a page turner, but it was still, you know, had more than its fair share of strong action and great political action with Mon Mothma's front. I was very happy with Empire's End.
It was definitely very satisfying for the readers, I think. Like you said, yeah, I wouldn't necessarily call it a page turner, but it was definitely satisfying in, you know, being the cap of a trilogy and you know, it satiated, you know, the thirst for action and all of that. I totally agree.
And I also have to, I guess, tip my cap to Chuck Wendig. I know his writing style kind of irked a lot of people who didn't even bother with part two or three once they struggled with his writing style in part one. And to be honest, it didn't bother me. But my hat is off to the man because there was a lot of pressure. He must have felt a lot of pressure throughout. Because this trilogy sort of set the table for that 30-year gap, and this, you know, this is an era that we really want answers to, and this book or this trilogy was really intended to lay out the chess pieces for us and situate players old and new into what's been going on. So I think Chuck Wendig did a pretty good job overall.
Absolutely. Yeah, like you said, the writing didn't really bother me as much as it seemed to bother other readers. I've read some pretty weird books in the before, so maybe I'm kind of used to authors experimenting or and doing weird stuff with their writing. You know, maybe that's just based on my own experience, but yeah, I mean, either that or it just grew on me. You know, because we had kind of three books to digest his style, and I think it definitely worked.
Yeah, in the end, I think. Either whether you get used to it or not, I think it worked because, well, the book starts off, you know, if it was familiarity you were craving, then you got it right off the hop. As I think the prologue puts us right on the Death Star 2, right before the Battle of Endor. And so Palpatine is talking to Gallius Rax, and this is when he sends him out to Jakku, to prepare for the quote unquote contingency. And so. We're kind of plunged right into a familiar setting, and if fans were wanting for that, then you got it, and it kind of plunges you right into some meaty territory. Did you feel that same sort of warm embrace?
Absolutely. You know, I think having the Emperor involved in the story really. Strengthened the bond in the story itself, you know, connecting it to you know, the movies that we love and moving forward. It really, this book, I don't want to jump too much to the end of it because I, you know, we kind of want to go through it all, but it really set up a nice trajectory, I think, and starting with the Emperor really helped to solidify like Wendig's vision for it and kind of setting up a nice that bridge, I think we were all kind of craving between this and the new era.
Yeah, I think so. Well, so instead of breaking down this book novel by novel or chapter by chapter, excuse me, we'll just hit on a few things and then we'll talk about maybe our favorite characters, what worked for us, what didn't, and then maybe a few final thoughts. And we'll also be sure to hit on Chuck Wendig's patented interludes. So I guess the first thing we should probably talk about is Palpatine's craziness and his plans. Even in death, this guy was still the boss of the Empire. It's been established now that he had created these observatories all over the galaxy, each with a different purpose. And the one on Jakku was playing the role of the contingency, meaning that Palpatine didn't want the Empire to go on without him. He felt that if the Emperor should fall, well, the Emperor should fall with it, and the greatest shame for all of the underlings of the Empire is that you let the king fall. Which, man, what a vain, egomaniacal man. We kind of thought that before, but boy, oh boy, this guy was just top of the crop when it came to self-aggrandizement and vanity, wasn't he?
It really fits the god complex that they've been building in the novels. If you think back to, where they were talking about his vision for, like, controlling the galaxy, like, on a grander scale.
That was in Tarkin.
That was Tarkin, where he's talking about his grand plan and his vision for wanting to, you know, shift reality or whatever, you know, that whole spiel. He really had a god complex. And you see that here on a smaller level with the Empire. Like, if he can't control the Empire and the Empire falls, then it shouldn't exist.
Yeah, so he felt that the you know, they kept alluding to this game, and I can't remember the Star Wars name for this game, but it's more or less our equivalent of chess, I would think. That if you feel like you're in checkmate, well, you just kind of knock the board over and start again. You know, like that little kid who just has to smack over the whole game board because he can't stand losing. And it was that same idea with Palpatine, that if we're going to lose, we're going to lose on our terms. We're going to blow ourselves out and we'll start over. So what they had done to Jakku, you know, under the supervision of Gallius Rax, using a droid army of some kind, is that they had A, built this observatory, but B, they had turned Jakku into sort of a bomb. They had drilled down to the planet's core and would use the Sith artifacts to toss down into the core to activate the detonation sequence, I guess, which is kind of weird to me. And it almost worked. But, the heroes were there to save the day, as they usually are. But yeah, the plan was, with this bomb of the planet of Jakku, that it would be used to wipe out the remnants of the Imperial fleet. But at the same time, he was also working on a map of the unknown regions of space, wild space, whatever it's called. And this is sort of where he had sent his super star destroyer, the Eclipse, if I'm not mistaken. And he sent that along with some scraps of the Empire out through into this unknown part of space. And that's where he meant for the Empire to sort of recoalesce itself away from prying eyes of the New Republic.
What I thought was cool about that, they name dropped Thrawn. And Thrawn was really the source of his knowledge of the unknown space. You know, that's really where he got that information from. So I thought that was kind of cool. You know,
Thrawn shoved in there right at the last second, eh?
Mm-hmm. But this is also kind of cool because I didn't really think I would be coming out of this with too many Snoke theories. But, you know, he was kind of driven by that presence. You know, he sensed some dark force out there. And that's what kind of helped, you know, guided him to wanting to explore the unknown regions. So a lot of people are saying that dark presence, whatever it may be, could possibly be Snoke, is, you know, why he ended up becoming the supreme leader of the First Order. So, I don't know, did you pick up on that at all?
Well, yeah, when it came to, you know, Leia's bit in this book, she always, you know, when she was like internal monologuing about, you know, being pregnant and feeling a connection with a young Ben in her womb, she had this feeling of dread that, you know, there was this dark entity that was sort of following them, and just she couldn't shake it. She just felt this impending sense of doom. You know, she kept there's all kinds of foreshadowing about Ben being a fighter and just being conflicted, and you very much got the sense that Snoke was already watching this unfold.
Right.
Somehow. Who knows where he was at this point, how he was able to sense what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
But it very much feels like a Snoke is here in this book, even if we don't see him by name.
Right. I mean, I'm sure it's no coincidence that as she's pregnant with Ben is when she's starting to feel this dark force. What I thought was interesting, going back to Life Debt, the second book, she had a dark force, like a dark vision, but it referenced two babies, which I thought was interesting. And I don't know if it was meant to be literal or symbolic. What leads me away from it being literal is that, you know, she only had one child. Could the two babies be more symbolic in that maybe Ben has two sides, the dark and the light, and that's maybe what he's fighting between?
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that could explain it. There's other interpretations. I mean, then I was like, well, is the other baby Rey? I mean, who knows?
Somehow born 10 years later.
Right.
Leia was pregnant for a really long time.
That was a long time to be pregnant. But who knows? That's why it kind of leads me a little more towards more of a symbolic picture.
I mean, I'm no doctor, but I feel like a lot of people are pregnant with twins and only end up having one as one, you know, dies in utero.
That's true too.
It's either too weak or one of them hogs all of the resources and space in that relatively small little spot. So maybe maybe that's more foreshadowing of Kyle, that he was already a murderer when he was not even born yet.
I mean, that'd be interesting if they do.
A dark place to go, yeah.
But it's, I mean, it is possible. I mean, it'd be interesting if they do explore that at some point. because they kind of just skipped to him being born. There really wasn't a, you know, a chapter or a scene about his birth, if I'm remembering correctly. I think it just kind of, he was there, right? It was more of a time jump.
Well, right, yeah, right at the end, once the battle is over and everything's kind of settling down, there is, I guess, a couple pages about Leia and Ben being born. And they talk about the spread of rumors across the galaxy that it was an easy birth or it was a difficult birth or he was born with teeth, which is some sort of metaphor for, I guess, for being ruthless.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's something that's already been used sort of in stories of old. He was born with hair and with not, like, there was already all kinds of stories about this kid. It was almost like he was destined to be somebody, which I guess when you have Han and Leia as your parents, yeah, I guess you are sort of a marked personality. But yeah, that only happened at the end of the book. This book was pretty jam packed, but
mm-hmm.
you know, I feel like most of the story was the build up to the battle, and then you had the political angle. Dealing with Mon Mothma and her hanging on to her chancellorship. And so you had her main rival, his name was Tolwar Wartol or something like that.
Wartol, yeah, yeah.
A real jerk.
No.
a real asshole, if I have to be frank about it. But he was trying to wrestle away the election from her. And one of the things that this whole era of Star Wars is sort of redefined the character of Mon Mothma to me. In the brief moments that we see her in Jedi, we obviously don't learn too much about her, but it's now in Rogue One and in Rebels and in the Aftermath series, we see that she's always, she doesn't act with her heart. She's always using her head and always thinking big picture. And in this one, she kind of plays the political game. I don't know, how do you feel about Mon Mothma now after all this stuff has gone on with her?
I think you bring up a good point. Like, she really has a bigger presence as far as just the overall lore of Star Wars goes now. I think, it's interesting. I kind of pair her with Leia in the sense that both politically active, whereas in Leia kind of fell more towards the military piece. Mon Mothma was still kind of holding on to that political side.
She's still very much believed in the political process.
Exactly.
Whereas Leia just was more about taking action.
Exactly. It could be good, could be bad. I don't know necessarily there was a case made to be, one or the other. I think they work as a good team overall, building the Rebellion and now the new Republic. But I think I look up to her more as a character, especially after this trilogy.
Yeah, you could tell that she takes it very seriously. But you could tell that she's not one to just rush to action. We saw that in Rogue One where if you didn't have unanimous support to attack the Empire, well, we're not doing it. We need full support. And she was always playing that big picture game. So I think she's still a great character, but I do think differently of her now in this new era of Star Wars than I would have previously, I think.
On a positive, negative, or somewhere in between?
More that I just think of her as a different animal now. Like, she's purely a political beast.
Mm.
I don't know if that's a good or bad thing.
It's just a different kind of character than we originally thought of.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's cool because it makes her different than, say, the rest of the Rebellion. Because she really tried to, represent, like you said, that political process that... That the unanimous decision, like, if we're going to go into this, we have to go into it all together. you know, you could definitely see that she believed in, you know, there's strength in the number and in unity. You know,
she believes in the ideals of a republic. Sorry.
Yeah.
You know, she didn't just want to do things willy nilly. It had to be voted upon and agreed upon, and this is what we're going to do. And she held steadfast to those old beliefs. Which is what a leader in a democracy does. You know, it gets messy, and you can very easily, as Mon Mothma finds herself in this book, you can be questioned and made to be an unpopular figure pretty easily. And Chuck Wendig painted the picture that, you know, her leadership and her hold on the chancellorship was really in jeopardy. Like, she mm-hmm. was almost out of there.
Yeah.
It seems like she hung on despite what, two assassination attempts throughout the three books.
There's a lot of assassination attempts in the Star Wars lore, just in general.
Yes, well, it's an effective thing to get to get the plot moving.
Yeah.
She serves as a very effective foil to Leia, which I think is what maybe her main purpose is, you know, someone to keep the fiery type like Leia in check.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like there's more that we can say about Mon Mothma, but just for the sake of moving on, coming into this book, were you thinking that Rax was going to be Snoke? Did you think that we were being led there by the nose?
I know that was a prevailing theory with a lot of the readers. I don't know if I had necessarily thought that Rax was going to be Snoke. I mean, mainly because there's so many Snoke theories out there. I was like, nah, I don't know. I think he's just, you know, an Imperial. But I could see, you know, the red herrings there, you know, because they obviously were setting up. It had seemed that Rax would be, you know, picking up the mantle from the Emperor. You know, it really kind of led you to believe that he would be the next leader. And as we know in the new trilogy, you know, that leader is Snoke. So that, you know, those connections are drawn. You know, that possibility is there. But I guess I kind of went in, you know, forcing myself to be skeptical. You know, with so many theories floating out there, you know, it's easy to kind of fall into the black hole of one of them, you know?
Yeah, I feel like some of the descriptions of Rax in the previous books made it clear that it was Snoke,
mm-hmm.
but then he would omit certain details that would make you second guess yourself. And in the end, the closer we got to Empire's End's release, the less and less I thought we were going to get Snoke. And so it turns out that he's not. He's a regular human, and Snoke appears to maybe not be human.
Mm-hmm.
That was ruled out pretty much right off the hop.
I mean, I think like you said it earlier, like, you know, Snoke, his presence is there, even though he's not explicitly in the novel. I mean, this whole story really is kind of the launching pad of the First Order. You know, we see the Emperor's plan, and his plan was to get to this dark presence out there. So I think this is really the road to Snoke. I think thematically and tonally, you know, in a lot of the descriptions that Wendig used, you know, Snoke is there. You know, a lot of that foreshadowing, you know, we're really starting to see the tone of the new trilogy and the new era kind of start to grow here.
Definitely. I felt like this book also served as a bit of a passing of a torch, because we expected, you know, Han to get into the cockpit of the Falcon and fly out to Jakku and you know, zip around space and start shooting down TIE fighters. But that didn't happen. It seemed like he wanted to, but I guess fatherhood called and he decided not to do it. So it was almost like this. Is passing of the torch the right word? I don't know. But a changing of the guard, so to speak.
Evolution of the role. You know, what I loved in I think it was... Well, they definitely did it at Empire's End. I don't remember if they did it in Aftermath. in Life Dead and the first one. But I love how in they kind of mirror the perception of Han in The Force Awakens here. You know, there's a lot of people who are like, he's a smuggler now. No, he was a war hero. No, he's this. And it reminded me of the first time that he met Rey. And I think Rey and Finn were talking about him. And Finn was like, war hero. No, the smuggler. And this, so it was this confusion about his role. So it mirrored that, you know, that he wasn't the Han that we knew, you know, in the original trilogy.
Yeah. So I mean, everything in this book leads up to this Battle of Jakku, and finally the New Republic. It took two votes, but Mon Mothma finally got her vote pushed through with a little bit of scheming on her part with some weird exotic fruit, which was kind of strange. I didn't know ships could scan for fruit from orbit, but that's another story. So she gets her vote, and she's able to send the New Republic fleet, or most of it. I was mistake calling it the Rebellion. I still call it the Rebellion, but at this point it's the New Republic. She's able to send them out to Jakku to take on the Empire. And this big epic battle ensues. And I felt like Wendig did a really good job of describing the action, both on the surface and in orbit. And one thing they kept harping on was the fact that the Ravager, the Empire's, it was pretty much their last superstar destroyer, was the focus of the Imperial fleet, and that was the big nugget that the New Republic had to crack. But it's really tough to sink one of these things. And I thought, well, no, it's not. Two A-wings basically destroyed one in Return of the Jedi, so just take it down. I always thought that was sort of a lame thing about Return of the Jedi. But the way that the Ravager was destroyed using the tractor beam from one of the Republic Starhawk ships to drag it down to the surface, I thought that, you know, that's how you kill a Star Destroyer, a Super Star Destroyer for that matter.
Oh yeah, I mean, I loved the action in this. I think Wendig really did he really gave us, like you said, like a nice 360 of the whole thing. Just the visual. Like, part of me wishes this was a movie so I could see that thing crash into the planet.
Yeah. It would have been really cool to see that on screen. But again, he did a great job of, you know, this thing, like, blocking out the sun and, you know, almost like turning the day into night because this huge object is just falling from the sky. It was just super well done. I also like some of the references to The Force Awakens. I think the Tirfon Aces got a mention in there, which, of course, you know, Rey is wearing the helmet of one of these pilots. Mm-hmm. So that was cool. And just overall, seeing how this ship graveyard took shape, I found that pretty gratifying.
Oh, 100%. And something I thought the book did really well, and this is kind of taking a step back, but just speaking of Jakku in general and kind of building the importance of this planet, I thought that he did a fantastic job. Even going back to, you know, Nima the Hutt, the Nima outpost, I thought that was really cool way to kind of introduce yes. that. You know, like you said, just going back to the purpose of Jakku. And the whole lore, I thought it was just a really, and it was interesting. I think it was you or Corey posted a poll about, like, what's the most important planet to Star Wars mythology. And I don't think Jakku was up there. Am I remembering that right?
Yes, I think so. Yeah, that was one of Corey's earlier Twitter polls. And yeah, I don't think Jakku was on that list, but I think it's because it had only been in one movie, right?
Yeah.
But we made the distinction to say that, you know, give it time, Jakku was probably going to belong on this list before long.
Oh yeah, and I think this novel really kind of puts it on the map. so to speak, just of importance.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's in the top four, but it certainly elevates it a lot more than The Force Awakens left it at.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with regards to Jakku and what it now represents to the Star Wars galaxy, did your expectations of what this planet was going to hold line up with what we got?
I think so. I didn't think that the planet was going to be some hub of explanation as far as like the Force and the Jedi. I figured it would be more so importance for the Empire and the First Order. And of course, we got this whole plot of taking the children and kind of molding them into these little psychos, for lack of a better word.
they were a little murderous psycho.
We kind of get the origin of Hux here. It makes you wonder, is like, you know, why Jakku in the Force Awakens? You know, like, you know, is this where Finn came from? Possibly. Well, I mean, as far as his age, I'm sure maybe they were taking kids from other planets at that point. But like, why go back? You know, like, why bring Rey back there? You know, and it kind of just like makes you wonder, is like, you know, like, what is the bigger picture? You know, like, obviously the Emperor picked it as his contingency plan. You know, it's the hub of, you know, these trainings for the kids. You know, just kind of like, you know, what is the bigger picture? Why, you know, why do they have to go back as far as the story structure goes for the whole lore?
Yeah. Well, you know, they had made mention of the fact that that Jakku was once a green planet with oceans and forests, and now it's a dust bowl. And I thought that whatever was going on in Jakku was going to be tied to that climactic event that would turn the planet from seemingly a nice place into a very inhospitable place. So I don't know if I took the bait, but maybe my expectations got away from me a bit, because I thought that whatever was in store for us on Jakku, it was going to be, you know, really deeply connected to, you know, ancient Jedi and Sith lore. But that wasn't really the case.
Mm-hmm. I mean, how long had they been drilling into Jakku? I'm trying to wonder how... Was it already a dust bowl when they started going into the core?
Yeah.
It was.
Yeah, I think in the beginning... Was it the opening chapter of Life Debt, I believe? It described Gallius Rax as a boy running through the sand following a shuttle that was coming in.
Right,
and that was was that Tashu on that shuttle, or was it Palpatine himself?
I don't.
When he stowed away, I think maybe it was just Tashu at that.
Yeah, point. I don't think it was Palpatine.
But you know, that was when they were just beginning work. You know, sort of in the Phantom Menace era. So I think that's when they began that work, because remember, Palpatine had put Rax in charge of that project.
That's right. That's right. And that had been a long time. But this is why I should have wrote it down. Did it have anything to do with... So where were the acolytes with the Sith? That was on...
Devaron.
That was on Devaron. I read some theory. You know what? I should probably go back to it. I forgot where I read it. But they were, you know... Someone was drawing some connection to... the withering of Jakku to some Force thing, but oh well, it escaped me where I fell in it. But anywho,
well, you know, I feel like that we're still gonna get that explanation. I don't know why they would have told us that Jakku, or why would they even conceive of Jakku being, you know, a lush planet at one point, to now be a Tatooine clone, for lack of a better term. I feel like we're gonna get that explanation.
Yeah, we have to, whether it's in another novel or a comic. But yeah, I would love to see that explored.
It feels like whatever caused that to happen is pretty heavy duty, and I don't think it's sort of it'd be a commentary on climate change. I think there's something big going on with that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, 100%. Yeah.
Overall, that was just the biggest oversimplification of what was a pretty complex book. It was everything leading up to the Battle of Jakku, all the political machinations that make it happen, and little side plots here and there between the characters, and it all sort of converges on Jakku. And like I said, we don't have time to get into every little plot detail. But what I want to do is talk about some of the interludes. I don't know if you made notes on any of them or if you have mental notes, but which of the interludes stood out to you?
So I loved seeing Lando and Lobot in Empire's End. I loved kind of checking in with them on Cloud City and them getting kind of that territory back. That really stood out to me. And kind of the big one that everyone was talking about going into Empire's End, the Jar Jar one actually kind of really stood with me. Not a huge Jar Jar fan, but for some reason, I really felt sorry for the guy.
Yeah, well, let's start with Lando. And like you said, it's about Lando, and he's with Lobot. And I believe it's with like the local Cloud City police, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not rebel troops. And they are slowly stamping out the Empire out of the city. And there's just one group of holdouts left. And yeah, the little interlude was a couple pages of getting this last Imperial cell to give up. And Wendig wrote Lando as the smooth talker we all know. And mixed in with a little bit of Lobot ribbing Lando for not having bought a wedding gift for Han and Leia, reminding him that he still needs to buy a baby gift for the upcoming birth.
Right, right.
So that was a pretty neat interlude. I mean, inconsequential, really, when you get to it. But it was nice to check in with Lando to see what he was up to. But yeah, then there's the Jar Jar one, which you alluded to. And yeah, I mean, we're back on Naboo. And what's become of Jar Jar since being a representative in the Senate? Well, he's been a clown. And, you know, at first I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure if... Is this Wendig sort of throwing more dirt on Jar Jar? Or is the way this being written, is this sort of a respectful sort of homage to the character and his kind heart?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think it's kind of a meta look at how we as fans view Jar Jar. Because, I mean, I think most fans who don't like him view him as kind of the clown of the prequel era. So it's kind of fitting to make him a clown, like a literal clown. Because I think that's kind of how people took him and perceived him. Like, people always kind of associated Jar Jar with, like, you know, the lowest common denominator, like, type of humor.
It was like potty humor, right?
Yeah, so it kind of made sense to make him a clown. So whether it was him throwing dirt on Jar Jar, I think it was more so like holding the mirror up to us as readers in a way. Like, this is kind of like how we viewed him, so this is kind of what he became in the story. It's kind of like reality influencing the story.
Yeah, no, I like the way you describe that. It certainly gave us a sympathetic picture of Jar Jar. You know, all the people sort of looking down at Jar Jar and being very condescending towards him. But he just goes on being Jar Jar. He's kind of happy just entertaining kids. And he connects with this one kid who's Mappo, I believe was his name. And I think there was something wrong with him, right? Like, he had like an injury or burn to his face or something like that.
Oh, I'm blanking about it. It sounds familiar. I think so.
Yeah, he was also kind of looked upon as sort of a freak. And, you know, Jar Jar completely takes to this kid and says, "Oh, no, we're going to be pals." And they kind of go off together and understanding that they're going to be partners together.
Right, they're going to clown around.
Yeah, like he was going to teach, Jar Jar was going to teach Mappo how to be a clown as well and how to entertain people. I thought that was just, it was a, you know, Jar Jar was always a bit of a naive character. Not in a bad way, but I thought it was a pretty fitting end. Like where I settled at the end of it was that Jar Jar was done justice with this story.
Right. I mean, you know, I didn't think they were going to give him some kind of like kill off or something. I think this was a nice, yeah, like a nice pleasant end to the character. Like just close the book on that.
Yeah, and I think the book is definitely closed on Jar Jar. No question about that. All right, so then we had a couple. I mean, there were a lot of interludes in this book, and we're not going to touch on all of them. We don't have time for that. But we were given two different ones. One sort of leaning to the dark side, and one leaning to the light side. So with regards to the light side one, it was Church of the Force followers who had seen it as their duty to return some kyber crystals to the crystal caves on Christophsis, which we all know from the Clone Wars series. And one by one, the group of this Church of the Force are killed off by, you know, creatures or just the dangers of the planet. And I thought it was another interesting exploration of the nature of kyber crystals. But also, this whole thing was punctuated by sort of a passage from the Journals of the Wills. And it goes on and on, but at the end, it says, "From a certain point of view." Which was a beautiful callback to Kenobi, of course, who, you know, I'm presuming that this is, you know, Kenobi's reading the Journals of the Wills. This is what he's been up to all this time on Tatooine in exile. And he adopts this certain point of view stance. I mean, I'm sure you picked up on that as well.
Oh yeah, yeah. I thought it was. Actually, I think those creatures. I could be mistaken. Were they force sensitive? I'm pretty sure they might have mentioned that they might have been force sensitive creatures as well. Which would be interesting because if they're by the home of the kyber crystals, does it influence the creatures around them? Whatnot? Did you pick up on that, or am I kind of?
No, I didn't get that, but. It doesn't mean it wasn't there.
Yeah, I think it was mentioned. Listeners can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was there. But, you know, I thought it was interesting just kind of like, you know, yeah, like you said, like more of the nature of the kyber crystals, you know, saying that they're bringing them back home, meaning that, you know, I think that connotes kind of a, you know, that there's just a natural hub for these, that they are like a living entity. Yeah, and then I agree with what you said about Obi-Wan.
Yeah, so it certainly sounds like Obi-Wan's been doing some reading. And yeah, so, and then over on the dark side of things, the Acolytes of the Beyond, this group of, I guess they can be described as Sith fanatics, and you know, the question we're left asking ourselves is, are these guys the groundwork of the Knights of Ren? They seem to have had a fascination with face masks and believing that, you know, they would give you power based on who wore it before, and that they were carrying around and sharing a Sith lightsaber, which I think was made pretty clear it was Vader's. Did they spell it out that it was Vader's lightsaber, or were we left to interpret that?
I think it was mainly left to interpretation. But I definitely was thinking that as well.
Yeah, and I think everybody else was as well. And you would see that a couple, a boyfriend and girlfriend couple, actually, you know, I guess feeling the dark side flowing through them, and they get into a fight, and the girlfriend puts the lightsaber right through her boyfriend's head.
What a lovely couple.
Yeah, I mean, probably could use some therapy before going to that length, but you know, that's what the Sith will do to you.
Right. I mean, I definitely don't think it's a coincidence that this particular story came out the same year as The Last Jedi, because I definitely feel like we're going to get some Knights of Ren mythology in the next episode. I mean, we have to at this point, because it was left so vague in The Force Awakens, but you know, it just left you wanting more. And I think that whole idea, because Kylo, he's so connected to his grandfather through the helmet, like that ideology is it's so prevalent there. And you could see that in the character of Kylo Ren, just the way, yeah, like with the helmet and that lightsaber belongs to me. Like there's a connection to the material, and that ideology is it kind of ties through. So I 100% agree that I think that this is at least kind of, if it's not exactly the Knights of Ren, yeah, it's sharing some mythos and some concepts. So yeah, if it's the precursor, it could definitely be.
Yeah, I think that's what that was meant to be. And then one that sort of near and dear to my heart was Chewbacca reuniting with his family.
Oh.
There's a scene of his son, and it was a great scene where Chewie and his son are finally reunited, and it had been years since they had seen each other, but it was good to touch base with Chewie to see, and to see where he ends up at the end of all this, and why, you know, what it brings into question for me is that, you know, we know that he reunites with Han at some point to go off on their adventures pre The Force Awakens, but it makes me wonder how close Ben Solo or Ben Organa, how close are they prior to The Force Awakens? You know, is there a relationship there? Because you see that Chewie takes a shot at Kylo Ren in The Force Awakens after he kills Han.
Right.
And seems like doesn't even hesitate. Now, is that because he, you know, there was not much of a relationship there, as they spent their most of their life apart?
It's hard to say because it's like it's definitely a gap of time I would love for them to fill in, because, you know, you get a sense that Han is dedicated to Leia, and Ben at this point, you know, Chewie is with his family, so it's like, where did it go wrong, so to speak? Like, where, you know, why did Chewie decide to leave his family? Why did Han decide to leave his family? I'm going to assume they reconnect after Ben is, you know, starts his training with Luke. So yeah, I mean, I would agree that I don't think Chewie and Ben really had much interaction. Because, you know, what we're led to believe is that they've spent some time apart, you know, both kind of reuniting with their families and starting those, you know, that chapter in their lives. So yeah, I definitely don't think that Chewie and Ben had much of a relationship.
Yeah, see, that seems to be the case, and I agree with that. That was not the image I was carrying with me all this time. I figured that for sure, you know, Chewie would have been there as sort of like the almost like an uncle type figure, a big hairy uncle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and would have been like a almost like a second father or a very protective father to this kid. But I don't get that sense at all.
And you know, other than this trilogy and the Forgotten Christmas special, I mean, do we really get much about Chewie's family? I mean, is this really their first mentioning, at least within the new canon?
I think so.
Yeah, so it definitely kind of, I wouldn't say it comes out of left field, but I mean, I feel like there would have been some mention prior, because how old, I mean, do we get a sense of how old his son is? Like, when did he have this kid?
That I have no idea.
You know,
I mean, so, he could be 50 years old for all we know, and that's still considered a kid.
That's true. Because in perspective, you know, I was trying to think, I was like, was this kid born during the original trilogy? At this point, who knows? It's still kind of left somewhat ambiguous. Actually, I was trying to remember, because I saw maybe about half of the Christmas special. I fell asleep. No surprise.
And I watched it in horror.
But I don't Was the kid, is it the, did the son share a name? Did he have a son in the Christmas special? I was trying to remember if it was the same name. Like,
it's, well, in Empire's End, it's just Waru.
Waru, okay.
And I think in the Christmas special, it's like Lumpa or Waru or something like that. So it, there's definitely a nod there.
Okay. I couldn't remember exactly.
I remember some people joking around saying, "Oh, the Christmas special is now canon." Wait, hold it just a second.
Let's not go that far.
Pump the brakes a little bit, please. those were sort of a few of the interludes that grabbed my attention. I'm sure there are more.
I mean, we have three novels of interludes. There were so many.
There were so many. Oh man, there were so many. I think we kind of outlined the main premise of the book, just everything spearheading towards Battle of Jakku. That was the point of this book. Want to touch on a few of the main characters before we call it quits?
Of course, yeah.
All right, who stood out to you?
I'm always a sucker for droids. Mr. Bones grew on me. I don't know, because I did the audiobook, so I don't know if it was the voice actor that really drew me in or was the character, but I mean, man, those droid deaths, I mean, between him and K2SO, it's just, I can't do it anymore.
I feel like droids now are being put into Star Wars because you can make them, there's ways to write the character that you attach yourself to them deeply.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but they can kill them because, well, it's just a droid at the end of the day.
Right.
And so that ends up being sort of the focal point of your loss, of the viewer's loss. And yeah, you know, Mr. Bones kind of got destroyed a couple times over the three books. But, you know, he had this one time, he had this weird programming that he would fix himself. But the second time around, no such luck. He was atomized by rebellion blaster fire.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it was, so in the audiobook they had him sound kind of like a distorted version of the prequel battle droid, like the Roger, but a little like more, they kind of gave him like a bit of an echoey distortion. So every time he would say, like, "I have committed violence," it was hysterical. I would just be in my car cracking up. So
I was able to have that voice in my head the whole time, and almost, and you know, the all caps when he would speak, that also would help because you'd always feel like he would be shouting.
Yes,
I perform violence, Master Tamin.
Yeah, exactly, and that's exactly how they performed it in the production of it. So it's. Yeah, no, he just, the sense of humor grew on me, and his relationship with Tamin I thought was great, and he would always just kind of like, he just felt like another person in the crew. So I definitely really appreciated Mr. Bones. And I really ended up liking, actually, there's not a character I really didn't like.
Yeah.
You know?
Right? Like, I found myself, you know, partway through this book, and I think maybe even the tide was turning some point in Life Debt, but definitely by the time I was getting deeper into this book, I caught myself saying, I like all these new characters now. I think Nora's parental ability is questionable.
Yeah.
But she's certainly a cool character and a brave fighter.
Right.
Singer was an absolute standout, maybe the standout of the book for me as far as new characters go.
Mm-hmm.
He's right there with Mr. Bones. Snap Wexley, you know, being somebody that we've latched onto from The Force Awakens, sort of that anchoring force, so to speak. We see him kind of grow up. There was Jace, or is it Jace or Jace? I was never sure how to pronounce her name.
Oh, like Jazz, like the music.
Or Jazz, like, yeah, exactly. I kept alternating between all three as I read the book.
Yeah.
She was really cool.
No, I was going to say, her arc, I really enjoyed. Going from bounty hunter to really caring about the crew that she was in. Kind of, you know, she was all about getting paid and you know, paying her debts, and eventually I think it was in life debt, I think, where it was like, I think Sinjir goes to her, he's like, you didn't even ask about the pay. And she's like, oh, I meant to, I just assumed we were gonna get paid. And you could just kind of see that evolution, and I really think Wendig did a fantastic job with her.
Yeah, a little Han Solo-esque, right?
Yeah.
Someone who's in it just for the money at first, but then later finds herself actually caring about the cause.
Mm-hmm. Oh, 100%. You can see that mirroring, yeah.
There's almost like a Seinfeld moment where she's like, I care. Oh, I care. And she's all disgusted with herself that she actually is emotionally invested in the outcome.
Yeah.
I guess the only character I really didn't care a ton for was John Barrow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, him. Him and I would actually say Brenton I didn't care too much for. I understand it was important for the family dynamic, but I wasn't too crazy about him either.
Yeah, you never knew if he was coming or going.
Yeah, but John... I feel like for him it was really more of... I think he benefited Jazz's character more than kind of his own. You know? I think it was someone that Jazz could care for, and it was kind of like another crack in the shell for her. But as far as his character, I wasn't crazy about it either.
Yeah, well, I think traditionally, you know, in our male-dominated world, that usually those, you would flop those two genders, right? Where it would be the guy who plays the leading role, and the woman is sort of the foil that serves as motivation.
Exactly. So in that sense, yeah, that was good.
Yeah, they flipped that script, and I think for the better, because Jazz was a pretty damn cool character.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, even though Jom didn't make it, and his death was only alluded to after the fact, I did like the fact that, you know, he went back for her when he really didn't have to.
Yeah.
And ended up paying for it, and it kept Jazz awake for like a good week or weeks on end. She had a very difficult time with that.
Yeah. I totally agree. Trying to think of who else. I just love that we got more Han and Leia, you know, because I know that was a main concern going into the trilogy. You know, people were really turned off by the lack of our main heroes. And I think even though they were still pretty much side characters, they were much more prominent. And I think it added a lot of depth to them and their overall story across the board.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Han never got too deep into it, though. He never strayed too far from Leia in this book, her being, you know, 9+ months pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
He was always within range, except for, you know, a short stint where he took off to go spy on, get some answers from some corrupt senators.
Right.
But for the most part, they left the key action to the new players. But, you know, I think the most telling arc was saved for Sinjar, who started off as an Imperial, intelligence for the Imperial Navy.
Yeah.
And then sort of just like, as things went to hell on Endor, where he was stationed during the Battle of Endor, he just sort of like, well, I guess this is over with. I guess I'll go with them. And he sort of blends in with the rebellion and becomes part of it. And you slowly, over the course of the three books, see him as well start to care. You know, to the point where in the third part, the Chancellor, Mon Mothma, is offering him jobs to, you know, stay with me. Be legitimate. We'll expunge your record as an Imperial, and you'll get this cushy gig as an advisor. But I definitely enjoyed his wit and his humor. That was a huge highlight throughout the entire trilogy. You know,
yeah, always drinking.
Always drinking, and sometimes rather heavily.
I liked his friendship with Jazz. I thought they had a pretty good dynamic, those two.
Yeah, as two people who very hard exteriors, they could kind of smell that on one another, right?
Mm-hmm.
They kind of knew that, you know, for all the gruff exterior and the appearance of not caring, yeah, they kind of knew.
Right. I mean, it got to the point where he was threatening Jom if he ever hurt Jazz. So I thought that was cool. I like to see that.
Sinjar was obviously able to inflict pain. That was part of his job. But Jazz is more than capable of taking care of herself.
Right.
Nora Wexley, she of the questionable parenting skills, but absolutely top notch when it comes to the piloting. You know, I thought that her relationship with Wedge was a little bit on the creepy side. Like, if you do the math, like, she must be considerably older than Wedge. Like, Wedge has still got to be in his, you know, he's a teenager in Rebels, right?
Right, right.
He's a kid. And this is about 6-7 years later. So he's maybe in his mid-20s in this book.
Mm-hmm. So she has to be much older to have a teen son.
Yeah, I mean, she's got to be in her minimum early 40s.
Right.
Which I thought, that's a little weird. Okay, whatever.
You know, honestly, I didn't even, like, I didn't even pick up, I didn't even think of that as it's happening. I was just like, I kind of just took it. I was like, oh, okay. Then I didn't even think of the age difference. But
I thought that was sort of an unneeded wrinkle in the book, though, because it, in the end, it went nowhere.
Right. I mean, it just led to some, you know, awkward exchanges between Temin and Wedge. It didn't really... She didn't end up with him. Like, it didn't really go anywhere, like you said. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that part could have been left out. But otherwise, I thought Nora was pretty cool. I mean, she's... I would say she's probably the main character through the three books. I mean, it sort of feels like her story. If you had to choose one of the new cast, I would probably say it's hers.
Right, kind of. No, just kind of her journey from, you know, being a Rebel pilot to now kind of dipping out and then going back into it and being a hero again. And it kind of, it was a very, I thought it was an interesting arc for her.
Do you think we'll see any of these characters again?
I don't know as far as a main character capacity. Obviously we see Snap again, you know, in the movies, and he's in the Poe Dameron comics. But I mean, it's definitely possible. I mean, these novels, they're going to be pumping out so many every year now. So it's possible. I don't know if they would make their way up to the movies, other than Snap, but I could see some more novels or comics kind of exploring kind of this era for sure.
I think, yeah, it's, I mean, these are Wendig characters. So if you're going to give them to somebody else, that somebody else to write them would really have to do them justice, especially somebody like Sinjar, who has such a signature sense of humor. Like, I feel like it would be tough to get him right.
Right. I mean, I could see Wendig, you know, doing a novel, maybe the early years of Ben, you know, maybe tackling Ben's early training with Luke, and then in that sense having like what's going on with the New Republic, so we can get Sinjar working for Mon Mothma, because there, you know, there's still so much time to fill in here, you know, because we still have so many years between Empire's End and Bloodline, for example, you know, because now we have Ben as a baby, and then Bloodline, Ben's already a teenager off with Luke, so there's still a lot of gap there to explore.
Yeah, there sure is. And I do hope we see some of these characters again. Any final thoughts before we start to wrap things up?
Not that I can think of. If you had to rank the novels, what, you know, whether alone or as a... So, I guess, okay. So, my question for you is, how would you rank each one? And then, if you had to give the overall trilogy a ranking, how would you rank them?
So, I would give the first one, like, a 5/10. I would give Life Debt, maybe a, you know, 6.5, 7. And I'd give Empire's End, I'd give that a solid 7.5 to 8. And overall as a trilogy, probably a 7. I'm not going to pretend that this was the best Star Wars reading I've ever done in my whole life. But yeah, I feel like overall, it did a pretty good job.
Yeah,
I don't know. How do you feel?
I think my scores are a little higher than yours. I think I enjoyed the first one more than most people. I wouldn't give it like a high score. I would probably give it more of like a 6.5, maybe a 6 for the first one. And then I really enjoyed Life Debt and Empire's End. I'd probably give Life Debt like a 7. And then they kind of just go up. I would probably do 6, 7. And then Empire's End, I really did enjoy. I'd probably give that an 8. So if I had to average them, I'd probably give the whole thing like a 7.5.
Yeah, we're not too far apart, I don't think.
No, actually, no. Pretty in line.
Yeah, I feel like if you got through the first one, then the rest was going to be pretty easy. And it was. Like, two of the three novels I thought were good to very good. It was really that first one, which, again, you're introducing a bunch of new characters and you're, in some cases, having to let the air out of the balloon. A lot of people really expected this to be about Luke, Han, and Leia and more adventures against the scraps of the Empire. And that's not what they got. And a lot of people were really angry about that. And especially, you know, as the kickoff to the new canon, people wanted something with a little more razzle-dazzle to it. And that just didn't happen.
Right. But we definitely, I think part of it, I could definitely speak to Luke as a character anyway, because because it really wasn't part of Luke's arc to go up against the Empire. Really, you know, Luke's tussle with the Empire ended with Vader and the Emperor's death. You know, his job was done when that happened. You know, really, his goal shifted to figuring out what's next for the Jedi. So it really, you know, story-wise, it really wouldn't make sense to get much with Luke as far as in this story, because he was, you know, this wasn't what his goal was. This wasn't his arena. You know, he was off doing his thing, and they, you know, they talk about it. They, you know, he gets some, you know, some mentions in the trilogy. You know, with Han and Leia, you know, yeah, I mean, we would expect them more, and we definitely got that. But yeah, no, I definitely don't think it, you know, it fell in line with most expectations. But we definitely don't want them to force something that wouldn't feel natural for the character. You know, whereas in, because Luke's, that's not Luke's arc, you know?
Yeah, and again, a lot of people frustrated that, you know, Luke was virtually, you know, extinct from this trilogy. He got a few mentions, some, you know, some wisdoms that he had passed on to Leia, but that's it. Everything else was reserved for everybody not named Luke.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the Luke stories are coming, but I think they're purposefully withholding them until stuff is revealed in the new trilogy.
Oh yeah. The movies have to kind of play themselves out first.
Exactly, because I think whatever he's finding out, the temples he's going to, all this stuff he's researching, I think if we got those stories now, it would kind of lessen the impact of any reveals that we would get.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, we kind of just, as fans, have to be patient, you know? And luckily, I mean, we don't really have to wait that long. I mean, this trilogy is coming out fast. I mean, it's just every 2 years, which is not a bad wait at all. So, we're pretty fortunate in this era.
Oh yeah, this is, yeah, we are very much lucky to be alive in this era of Star Wars.
Yeah, I mean, and honestly, I think they, you know, they don't want to get too crazy with the comics and the novels yet, because presumably we're going to be taking a break from the saga. You know, I imagine there's going to be several years in between episode 9 and 10. So, if that is what they end up doing, I don't know. But I'm pretty sure, like, this is, this medium, aside from the TV shows, is really what's going to carry, you know, I mean, they'll do the anthologies and stuff, but it's going to carry, I think, our main characters and their stories for a while until that next break is over.
I agree with that.
So we'll see. I'm sure there's a lot more coming.
That is an absolute guarantee. All right, well, I think we're done here.
Yeah. We touched on a lot, I think.
Oh, you know what? The last thing I'll say is one thing I thought interesting as I closed up the book. You know, Luke and Leia, born on or around Empire Day. It's, you know, that's sort of the feeling you leave Revenge of the Sith with, that as the Empire is born, Luke and Leia are born as well. The two people that will help bring about its downfall. And now on the day that Mass Amita comes out of hiding to surrender the Empire is the day that Ben is born.
Yeah.
And I thought that was interesting.
And I mean, and another layer to that is, you know, if this is the, you know, this start of the First Order, that kind of happened on that day as well, kind of the end of the battle. Well, was the Battle of Jakku kind of the same day as the signing, or was that a flash forward?
The signing happened after.
It was like way after. Okay.
Yeah.
But,
and you know, I think it's important to note that, you know, there were still, you know, factions of the Empire that didn't recognize the treaty, mm-hmm. or the ceasefire, surrender, whatever you want to call it, and they kept fighting until they fled, or until they were stamped out. But yeah, I mean, whoever was left, you know, geez, we didn't talk about Rey Sloane once in this entire.
That's she's an important part.
She's a huge part of this book, and we didn't even touch on. People must have been screaming at their iPads and whatnot. Yeah, I mean, how can we forget Rey Sloane? Jesus. So Grand Admiral Rey Sloane, who really was sort of the head of the Empire, or so she thought. Turns out she was merely a puppet for Rax's plan. In the end, she's the one that takes out Rax. And, you know, with his dying words, he implores her to, you know, take the Emperor's yacht, which they had there on Jakku, and follow the coordinates and rebuild the Empire out in wild space. And so she takes that opportunity. You know, she kind of reclaims her Empire and gets those murderous children and a young Hux and... Brendel Hux. She gets all these people on board and she's kind of left there. But for somebody who occupies such a high rank within the Empire, I kind of liked her.
Yeah, I think what it was, I mean, it was, she definitely got what she wanted at the end. You know, for her, it was more so, it was all about the Empire. And it was her version of the Empire. And... you know, I think it was her drive. I think that's what made her a likable character.
Yeah, because, I mean, we see the Empire as these murderous fiends. And, you know, that's very intentional. That's the impression we're supposed to get. But in this new Star Wars landscape, where we keep getting different images from both sides of the fence, Rey Sloane really believed in the idea of you know, the rule of law and peace and justice through through the might of the Empire. And she felt like the rebellion was actually like terrorists. And Wendig also made it a point to say that Sloane was she was not loyal to the Emperor. She had no real feelings towards him. It was the Empire that she was loyal to.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which I think makes her distinct, and it makes her sort of separate from other Imperials. And that, okay, I see where you're going. She didn't strike me as a bad person. Just right. Somebody who's on the wrong side of history.
Right. But then you also have to kind of look at the moral ambiguity of it. It's like she had to have known the things that the Empire was doing as well. You know, enslavement and destruction of planets and all of this stuff. So, I mean...
This is true.
So, yeah. So part of it is like turning a blind eye to it, you know? Or... You know, ignorance is bliss. You know, even just because she wasn't doing it, that kind of like made the Empire okay. You know, so it's very interesting, I think. And you know, for a moment there at the end when she's kind of teaming up with Nora, and you know, working towards taking down Rax, you know, you really kind of felt that for a moment she wasn't gonna take up on Rax's offer. You know, that she was going to effectively, you know, defect from the Empire, and she was, you know, that possibility was there, you know, so I liked that, and she ended up picking, you know, the path of the Empire, and her ambitions kind of won at the end of the day.
Yeah, the ambitions were still there. You know, she questioned whether or not she still wants to be a part of it, but yeah, when she saw that she had the opportunity to rebuild the Empire from scratch, and she starts thinking about, well, you know, I'm new to this wild space thing. They've been here for a while. How long? Who's in charge? Are they going to accept me? But you're definitely left with the impression that she's going to be a factor in rebuilding the Empire, which I guess is really the seed of the First Order.
I would love to see a book just on Rey's perspective. Rey Sloane. It's hard. It's tough that they had two characters with Rey, but I think Wendig. It'd be cool if Wendig could do a novel, kind of picking up from here, maybe a few years moving forward, because they've really, between the comics and the novels, built a nice tight little like mythology for Sloane.
I mean, she's been in the comics. She's figured prominently in this trilogy of books now.
Right. She was in A New Dawn.
Right. Was she in Lost Stars? I don't think so, but she may have been.
I haven't read it yet. I gotta get to it.
I don't remember if she was in that or not, but either way, she's been in various materials, so she's obviously a key character for the Empire in the new canon, so hopefully we get more of her.
Yeah, because I definitely want to see how she factors into the First Order, because, I mean, we kind of know from Bloodline kind of some, you know, pieces of the First Order building. Because I'm trying to think, like, how many years between Empire's End to Bloodline. Because the First Order really wasn't quite finished yet, getting started, by the time Bloodline... Because Bloodline was about kind of getting... supplies, and you know, senators were involved and all that jazz.
Yeah, I think this is, if I had to, geez, some quick math, you know, Bloodline is 6 years before The Force Awakens.
Mm-hmm. I'm gonna say this is probably 15 years at least, because by Bloodline Kylo's got to be a teenager. He's off training with Luke still. He hasn't.
Well, sorry. Return of the Jedi is 30 years before The Force Awakens.
Right. So I think.
This is going to be 25 years ish.
Bloodline would be. Not that. Yeah.
Bloodline would be 24 years or so after Return of the Jedi.
Right.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So this would probably. So probably like a 15 year gap. So I would love to see some stories of like, you know, a young First Order, and like what it took for Sloane to kind of build that. You know, getting some early Phasma stuff would be really cool.
Hey, speaking of Phasma, did you think that one of those that tall girl on Jakku with the short cropped hair? Did you get the sense that was her? I forget what page that was on.
I don't think I thought that as soon as I read it, but actually when I was going back and kind of looking at different reviews and what people were saying about it, that had popped up a lot, and a lot of people were thinking. So I think that would be really cool if it was.
I think it was. I would be. It's got to be. That had to be Phasma, a young preteen Phasma.
I mean, it would just like make sense. It would be kind of cool, though. It would really kind of tie her closer to Hux and kind of just make it.
They were besties growing up.
Yeah. I mean, I think we'll definitely like, you know, it's hard because you don't want to put, you know, I don't want to put too many expectations on The Last Jedi. But I feel like because they withheld so much from The Force Awakens, that I feel like this stuff will be explored. But then again, you know, two hour 15 minute movie, you know, I don't know if they're going to get to everything. But if not, you know, something along the lines has to explore Phasma's history. So that would be fantastic. Yeah.
And I found the little passage. It's literally less than two lines. One of those children is a tall girl with her hair shorn to the scalp. Her face is dead. Her face is a dead, emotionless mask. That's it.
Mm.
That sounds like it could be easily be Phasma.
Right, right.
And she's there with Brendel and Armitage Hux.
Yeah, it's like, you know, why spend the time pointing that out? Like, you know, highlighting her for, even if it's a brief moment, like, why spend the words in the on the page, like, you know, when you're editing a novel, you know, it's precious. So there's obviously a point to it. So
let's go with it. That's it. That's Phasma.
It's Phasma. Let's do it. Yeah. No, I'm in. Sold.
All right. So luckily we saved ourselves at the 11th hour. Imagine we had gotten through this whole thing and not touched on Rae Sloane for a single second. But we did that now.
Yes, yes. So I'm trying to. I think we touched on all the important milestones. I don't think there's anyone else.
It would have been
out.
Impossible, really. I mean, we could have done a 3-hour show and bored everybody to death. But again, I think this hour and a half, whatever it is we're doing here, I think it's a pretty good way to summarize the book without giving away too much. I don't think. I think this is still a worthy pickup for Star Wars fans. If you don't want to shell out for the hardcover, well, hey, just be patient. The paperback will be out probably in less than a year from now. Grab it then, because I think this does a pretty good job of setting the table in the post-Jedi, pre-Force Awakens universe.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely recommend this one. Like you said, with the price, you know, the paperback will come out. I'm sure the Kindle price will drop significantly. Or, you know, whatever e-reader people use. But, I don't know, would you consider this necessary reading?
Ooh. Nah, wow. I feel like some of the data points are necessary. That's the eternal struggle of Star Wars fans in this new canon, right? It's are you looking for a good story, or do you just want the nuggets, the takeaways that you need to carry forward?
Right, and that's the tough thing, is like, it's because a lot of this is saved for the third book in a trilogy. So if people aren't really enjoying the first two, they're not getting those nuggets until, you know, the last novel.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Because you don't want to skip parts one and two and just read three. Because you'd pick up three and read a pretty action-packed book, but you wouldn't know anybody.
You wouldn't care about the characters.
At all.
Other than Han and Leia and the ones you already know.
But, and you'd be frustrated because, well, why aren't these in it more? Why aren't these characters in it more? And
right.
Why isn't Han and Lando at the Battle of Jakku? Yeah. I don't know. I hesitate to say it's a must, but I would certainly, if I was a hardcore Star Wars fan, I would certainly go out of my way to figure out the big takeaways from this trilogy.
Right. I mean, I think it's a must for the hardcore fans. It's a maybe for everybody else.
Yeah, like there are people who just go to the movies and aren't ever going to pick up these books. Yeah, whatever, that's fine. I don't think they're going to miss out. But if you're a huge Star Wars fan, you want some of this information.
It's going to give us nerds some bragging rights if we know this. Well, actually.
Well, yes. All right. Well, Steve, this was a blast as usual. I think we covered this book pretty well.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, anything that we didn't cover, if people have questions, they can tweet at us and we'll happily engage via social media.
Yeah, and if we left out any major characters,
you can yell at us.
Yeah, yell at us. Yell at where can people yell at you on Twitter?
At Joango Fett, GIOANGO Fett.
And you can scream your lungs out at me, all caps and expletives. You can send that all my way at Tumbling Saber on Twitter, or you can join us on Facebook. You can just Facebook.com/TumblingSaber. You can join our little community and yell at me there. I promise not to ban you. Instagram, you can find us there as well. And also, if you want to take 2 seconds and drop us a iTunes review, that would be greatly appreciated. And hey, look, if you're listening to us from Star Wars Celebration in Orlando this week, I hope, and I'm sure I speak for Steve when I say this, we hope that you are having a wonderful time. Say hi to everybody there for us, will you? And enjoy yourselves, have safe travels, and please do come back in a couple days for episode 70, I don't even remember anymore, 71, 72,
I think,
of the Tumbling Saber podcast.
I know you guys had your 70th.
Yeah? Okay, so episode 71 is right around the corner, where we will be recapping all the biggest news from Star Wars Celebration, and probably some more stuff in there as well. So again, have yourselves a great weekend, no matter where you are. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll catch you again soon. Bye for now.
You've been listening to Journals of the Willing from the Tumbling Saber team, a member of the Star Wars Commonwealth Podcast Network. Learn more about the network and its members at starwarscommonwealth.com.